Each of us has a unique career story to tell. For some, these fly high like rocket launches. For others, they're more like the game of chutes and ladders, with advances and setbacks along the way. Either way, we learn countless lessons from these experiences. And that's what we put into the spotlight here at Career Sessions Career Lessons. Join discussions featuring a variety of guests sharing their stories of ups and downs, as well as the secrets of their success and what drives them to continue moving forward. We break down the tools and resources that will help you establish your dream career and realize your professional goals. Here's your host, J.R. Lowry.
Hi, I'm J.R. Lowry, and this is Career Sessions Career Lessons, which is brought to you by Pathwise.io. Pathwise is dedicated to helping you be the best professional you can be, providing a mix of career and leadership coaching, courses, content, and community. Basic membership is free, so visit Pathwise and join today. Today, my guest is Saf Yeboah-Amankwah. Saf is Senior Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer at Intel Corporation. He leads Intel's Corporate Strategy and Ventures Group, focused on driving growth-oriented strategies, including strategic partnerships, Intel capital, equity investments, and incubation initiatives. Saf joined Intel in 2020 from McKinsey & Company, where he was a senior partner and global head of the transformation practice for the telecom, media, and technology practice. Prior to that role, he served as managing partner for South Africa and head of McKinsey's telecom, media, technology, and digital practice for Africa, among other roles. Saf holds bachelor's and master's degrees in electrical engineering and computer science from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's a current board member of the United Negro College Fund, the Department of Defense Business Board, and Mobileye. Saf, welcome. It's been a really long time. It'll be fun to catch up.
It's been a minute, so looking forward to it.
It's been probably about 18 years more than a minute, but we'll call it a minute. So you were at McKinsey a lot longer than I was. You joined Intel a little over 3 years ago. So tell us about your current role.
And by the way, thank you for inviting me to this thing. So I do three or four things at Intel. And I report to the CEO, Pat Gelsinger, who is an amazing human being who was at Intel 30 years, did many, many things, left for 10 years, and is now back driving the transformation. But I do four things for the company. One, I lead corporate strategy. And it's a classic corporate strategy team. We do portfolio work, do special projects. We look at sort of our M&A pipeline and agenda. We do a lot of work looking at benchmarking, look at the TAM. So basically kind of try and look around 3, 4, 5 years from now, whether or not the company is well positioned or not. The second thing I do is I run Intel Capital. So we have Intel essentially started the corporate venture capital tech. And so we've been investing for quite a long time, 25 years. But what we do is we invest mostly in Series A and Series B and C type. And we look at both things that are sort of ecosystem things, so not necessarily related to Intel, but also things that Intel cares about in terms of driving the ecosystem. Okay. And what we try and do is be the eyes and ears for the company, but also we try and make money, right? So we try and generate cash and cash returns. And we've actually done quite well the last, you know, 5, 7 years. And so I run that, you invest between $300 million to $500 million a year. And we do that. Yeah. So it's one of the largest. We invest in about four domains and we have about 25 to 30 professionals as part of the team. So that takes up quite a bit of my time. The other thing I do is I actually run three businesses for the company. So as part of the portfolio work that I do a lot of restructuring, resetting and incubation. And so right now there are about four or five businesses that are under my watch. One is the auto business unit, which we've been, you know, turning around. It's about $500 million business that we think should be much larger. And I can talk about that in a second and later on. I also run the silicon photonics business. Again, it's a business that we think is very strategic that I'm working to transform from pivoted from one business model to another. I also have a sensors business, a sensors and robotics business that we're incubating. So I manage that. I also run, we have a corporate partnership and alliances team that reports to me. So, you know, with M&A really tough and also how diverse our portfolio is, we found that doing partnership and alliances can sometimes be really effective at accelerating our business model inorganically. And so I have a very small but mighty team that look at pretty big team, big partnership opportunities that are not really M&A. They're not really sort of procurement. It's a real partnership and it takes, really requires a lot of creativity. And so I have that team as well. And then I have a few other small teams, but those are the four main things I do.
So as I mentioned, you'd been at McKinsey for a really long time. How did this opportunity arise and what led you to decide to make the jump after so long in consulting?
Yeah, it's interesting. So Intel was a client of mine when I was in McKinsey. It hadn't been a client for 7-8 years, because if you remember, I moved to Africa to lead a South Africa practice for a while. But before that, I'd served Intel pretty intimately. So I knew the company, I knew the culture. In fact, I often used to tell my McKinsey friends that this one company of all the companies that I'd served that I'd be excited to go work for on one day would be Intel, because the culture just worked for me. I'm a geek at heart. As you know, I'm an electrical engineer. And so I thought, and the work that the company was doing was always exciting. So when I came back from Africa, like many people, I was getting to a milestone age and it's 2-3 years from being 50 years old. And I was like, I got to do something different. I can't be at McKinsey my whole life, right? But at that point, I'd been at McKinsey 24 years and had done, you know, almost everything that I could do at McKinsey, and come back to North America. And I felt that I had another 2 or 3 more runs at me in me. And I wanted to do something different. McKinsey, as you know, well, JR, is the only company I'd ever worked for, right? I left MIT and came straight to consulting, been here for 24 years, and felt like before I start thinking about retirement, 5-7 years down the line, I kind of wanted to do a couple of things different. And so I got a call from the CEO. A couple of the board members had mentioned me as that he was thinking about kind of upgrading his team or kind of getting some more strategic help. The lady that was doing the strategy team, an amazing woman called Aisha Evans, had left to go to run Zooks, which is an autonomous car company. And she was also a client of mine. So she also recommended me. And so he called, and it took a while, but eventually I was like, you know, be part of hopefully biggest transformations in the tech sector. And so that's kind of how it got me into Intel.
So I guess knowing the culture, was it a big shock for you kind of switching from consulting into the corporate world, or because you knew the company so well, not so much?
It was a big shock, but it wasn't as blunt and difficult as expected.
Yeah.
Knowing the company, also knew a lot of people in the company who were my old clients. Most people at Intel are usually there 25, 30 years. So a lot of the people, most senior people, I actually knew from my past as a consultant. But having said that, it was a big shock. I mean, you were at McKinsey, dealing with budgets, HR issues. I had to spend a lot of time rationalizing a lot of portfolio and firing people, doing tough CPMs, having to deal with not just being an advisor, but actually a principal, negotiating deals. For the first year and a half, I also had the M&A team reporting to me. And I did a bunch of, you know, deals, which are totally all-consuming transactions. And then also kind of running businesses. So the way I like to think about it, it was like playing with live ammo. And you know, when the first shot comes over your head, you know, so that part for me was jarring. After six, 9 months, I kind of got my sea legs and I kind of felt comfortable. I think the other thing that really helped was that most of the top team were new, because Pat came in, but even before Pat came in, there'd been another CEO and a lot of changes. And so when I joined, most of the people in the senior team were kind of new to their roles. So it wasn't like I was joining a really well-formed oiled machine. We're all kind of figuring out our new jobs together. And so in some ways that really helped. But the transition from being an advisor, although as you remember, I did a lot of transformation work at McKinsey, right? So a lot of massive 3-year type programs where you become quasi sort of operational with the client.
Right.
And so I'd seen it, but having to live it as a principal was a whole new game.
Yeah, you certainly feel it more. I mean, I've been through those experiences a few times, and it's the people part of it, right? Like when you're in a consulting role, you're a step removed from it. When you're the manager who's having to tell somebody that they've lost their job, or even if you're in a more senior position and you're looking at the list of people who are going to be losing their jobs, I mean, it's a hard thing.
Yeah, and it never gets easy. I think what you realize very quickly, what I realized was that you got to treat people as adults. And you got to be fully transparent. You got to be very transparent about the economic and the strategic rationale. People respond well to that. I think you get into trouble when you try and spin things, right? I've seen people make that mistake. That does not end well.
Yeah. I mean, it's generally been my approach as well, just to be straight with people. I mean, we're certainly far enough into the era of layoffs, right? They've been going on for decades, probably since the 80s, that all of us, no matter how old we are, we've kind of grown up in this environment where it's just a part of business and you just have to accept that you were in the wrong place at the wrong time and not take it overly personally and move on.
Exactly.
And on the flip side, when you're the one having to deliver that message, as you say, you got to just treat people with respect and treat them like adults and let them get on with their lives.
I totally agree.
So talk about the transformation that you guys are going through at Intel.
We call it IDM 2.0, right? So IDM, if you remember, from a semiconductor perspective, is when you design and make your own chips, right? Mm-hmm. Don't interact with the world. That's been Intel's heritage. What we realized when we did a lot of work when Pat came back in was we had a fundamental fork in the road to make, right? Intel, was the IDM model still sustainable, right? You know, most of the IDMs over the last 20 years have exited manufacturing and given all of their manufacturing to TSMC or to GlobalFoundries or somebody else. You know, right. AMD famously split the company into two and so on. Based upon all the work and thinking that we did, we realized that actually the path for Intel was not only to be a great manufacturing design company making chips, but also to be the world's number two, to chasing to be the number one manufacturing capacity, both manufacturing technology and manufacturing capacity going forward, and to create a really credible Western alternative to TSMC from a manufacturing perspective. For many different reasons, this was the most, all the work that we did, this was strategically the most important path, the only real path we had to create shareholder value. And that change of trying to not only win in terms of technology, but capacity is a massive shift in strategy for the company, because it means that we also can't just manufacture for ourselves. We need to be able to manufacture for others. And hence 2.0, i.e. we also created a foundry inside Intel. Foundry, i.e. a contract manufacturer for semiconductors for third parties. And so we've been on a journey to both restore our leadership on the product design and product side, right? Sort of for the PC, the chips for the PCs, chips for servers, chips for edge compute. But we've also been on a journey to not only re-catch up with TSMC and Samsung in terms of manufacturing technology, but also be on a path to build leadership capacity on par with what TSMC is offering for leading node, for advanced manufacturing. That's a massive transformation on multiple different levels. On the product side, there's a huge transformation in terms of the way we design chips and the moving to a chiplet world. It also means a fundamentally different cost structure for operating the business. On the manufacturing side, it also means really accelerating the path of innovation for manufacturing technology in order to be able to catch up. We call it 5 nodes in 4 years, unprecedented activity. And also, we've committed to spend over $100 billion over the next 5 to 7 years to build next generation capacity, to be able to really catch up and create a leading capacity for the industry. So that's huge, bold aspiration and, you know, huge transformation, the way in which we are allocating our capital.
Is anybody else who's a designer doing what you guys are doing in terms of contract manufacturing?
So Samsung does, is 10 years ago, Samsung moved in this direction, but the amount of sort of contract manufacturing they do is pretty small, very few customers. And in terms of capacity to match the demand and also match TSMC, they are nowhere near that. So Samsung is the only real other company that has tried to go down this path.
How far into it are you guys?
So, you know, Pat came 3 years ago. So he came 7 weeks after I came. So I joked that I hired him. And we have been on this journey since he got here. We spent about 3-4 months once he came. It's just kind of, he had this strategy already in his mind, but we had to tune it and make sure that we could get the whole organization on board. And we've been on that journey since. And hence the CHIPS Act and hence the Arizona, Ohio announcements, or as well as announcements in Germany. It also speaks to quite a number of the announcements we've been making around packaging and bringing customers on board to Intel Foundry.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you certainly was, you know, with all of the kind of supply chain disruptions that we've seen over the last few years in particular, right, be it from COVID or just concerns about leaving manufacturing in places like China or the supply chain issues caused by just shipping. I mean, we're seeing this a bit right now in the Red Sea. We've seen it with the Suez Canal, the Panama Canal is having issues, you know, so the shipping industry's had its moments as well. How does that leave you guys in terms of how you're thinking about where you want your footprint to be?
It's funny, we spend a lot of time on this topic, as you can imagine, this whole topic, resilient supply chain. And not only resilient supply chain of our supply chain, but our suppliers' supply chain.
Exactly.
Like, you'd be surprised how $2 filter can stop the whole $20, $30 billion factory, right? So the short story is the industry spent 25 years moving to optimizing for cost and just in time. And the industry did an amazing job, right? So every single part of the value chain has been optimized for cost and just in time supply, which has meant for certain chemicals and certain supplies aggregating in China, for certain, you know, manufacturing in Philippines, for certain specialties in Germany or in Amsterdam. The industry's really optimized for scale and scope. The reality of COVID and the reality of the geopolitics is that we have to add another optimization lever, which is resilience, which means that we have to find a way to ensure that our supply chain, the industry supply chain, can withstand shocks similar to what we saw in COVID. Because it's very clear with all of the dynamics in geopolitics, but by the way, it's not just China. It's, you know, we have this issue in, you know, with Israel. Israel is a pretty big part of our supply chain. So was Ukraine and Russia in terms of talent supply chain, as is Latin America and so on and so forth. Embarked on for the last 2 years is dissecting every part of our supply chain and understanding what our supply concentration is, what's the cost to and time to replicate in a different geography or with a different supplier. What is the path to actually be able to qualify second and third type suppliers and so on and so forth. And we've gone through the supply chain and done basically created as much resilience as possible. What you can imagine is that there are segments of it that are very difficult to create resilience on, right? Chemicals from China. There's certain chemicals that are only processed in China, 90% controlled in China. There's certain manufacturing, by the way, of our customers that is only either in China or in Taiwan, right? A lot of the assembly is in that part of the world.
Right.
Obviously, huge amount of money, huge amount of time to try and create resilience. And so you have to think about what you do about it. And so there's a lot of work going on to figure out whether or not you can stockpile this. So huge amount of work that is going on to try and create some shock absorbers to the supply chain. Some of it, honestly, we don't think it's solvable by us alone or even by the industry. It requires support from the government and requires huge amount of investment that we as an industry need to figure out how we put down.
I know you're involved in the Defense Business Board. I would imagine that that's a central theme for them too, because that's ultimately parts of this really get at national security.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you take Taiwan for a minute, right? I mean, this is all, I think the reckoning was during COVID because of the supply chain issues. You couldn't get cars out, you couldn't get planes out. Literally can bring the whole global economy to a pretty big halt. Imagine if Apple and Microsoft and Amazon can't scale their data center capacity because they can't get servers. They can't get servers because the chips that, and maybe not even the CPU, maybe just the memory controller that is being manufactured in Taiwan can't make it. And all of a sudden you're stuck, right? So it's a very important issue. And hence you see all of the dynamics with the CHIPS Act, with the puts and takes between the US government and the Chinese government. And you see the push for most of the suppliers, most of the end customers in terms of the OEMs to really push hard around, hey, what are we going to do to create, you know, alternatives or create, you know, secondary suppliers just in case there's disruptions in the supply chain.
Switching gears, you mentioned earlier that I think you said there were four areas that you look at investing in your venture capital arm. What are those areas and what are some of the interesting things that you're seeing from the investments that you've made?
Sure. So we care a lot about the enterprise IT industry because we've historically, Intel has always felt that that is a segment that is a big driver of demand of our supply, if you will. And so all technology associated with enterprise, we look at to invest. And that could be in software, that could be in storage, that could be in security, that could be in, you know, you name it. But all around enterprise technology. The other area we invest in is in cloud infrastructure particularly. And when we say infrastructure, it's not just hardware, but also software and management of basically cloud infrastructure. Obviously, AI has become a very big part. AI infrastructure has become a very big part of that, but not only. The third area we spend a lot of time on, broadly speaking, is what I'd call manufacturing technology. So there is a lot of innovation going on in chemicals, a lot of innovation going on in tools for silicon designers. There's a lot of innovation going on in next generation substrates, next generation machinery for different aspects of semiconductor supply chain. Lots of innovation going on in packaging. We care a lot, obviously, about the resilience and sustainability of that part of the ecosystem. So we invest a lot in that. And then the fourth area that we spend a lot of time on is, broadly speaking, I'd say software, where we try and put money into up and down the value chain. Because, you know, what we found with our Microsoft partnerships and with all the other sort of partnerships is that, you know, software drives hardware. People say that software eats hardware, but software also drives a ton of hardware. And so one of the things as being the eyes and ears for the company is understanding what's going on in workloads and what's going on and driving, that is driving, you know, developers, what's driving application and ISVs. And so we invest in that segment as well to ensure that, first of all, they're usually good returns. Second of all, they give us good view in terms of what developers care about.
With the things that you're investing in, how common is it that you end up incorporating them into the core of the business versus they just end up kind of remaining an investment that you've made?
That's a great question. We've gone back and done an analysis on this. And I would say that overall, it's actually not as big as you would think. So less than 15% of the companies that we invest in at Intel Capital end up becoming Intel assets.
Yeah.
But there's some notable ones that have become Intel assets, right? So there's quite a number of the AI companies we invested in that are now part of the Intel business. But that is actually quite unusual. What we typically do, however, is we do a lot of partnerships with the portfolio companies in terms of them reinvesting, doing sort of NRE collaboration. We co-sell, right? We allow them to use our sales engine to accelerate their business. A lot of the time, these are companies that are very complementary to what we're doing or helping to solve problems that our customers care about. So we bring them to our customers. The most successful examples is when they become public and they are using our infrastructure, our technology, and references are pooling Intel with them. And those are actually probably more the norm. There are some notable ones where we've purchased. And sometimes that, obviously, my investment team is very sequestered from the rest of Intel. They've focused on alpha.
Right.
And my interventions is very much on the domains they should invest in and the way in which they should invest. And sometimes we use them as leverage to help the business units understand the segments that they're investing in. But their main objective is to generate alpha and then bring the lessons from what they're doing into the company as sort of on a pull-push basis.
I've sort of seen it from both sides. When I was at Fidelity and I was not involved in the investing activity that they were doing in terms of venture capital, they very much ran a venture capital arm almost as a completely standalone thing. At one point, it was actually, I think, spun out from the traditional company, go over to State Street, where we didn't do a whole lot of investing in the way that you're describing. It was all really things that we saw potentially becoming part of our business, either a technology or some services play. In some ways, we actually didn't really care so much about the return on the investment itself. I mean, obviously, we didn't want to throw money away, but we were more doing it to kind of keep a pulse on what was going on out there that might be interesting in our business. So every company kind of does it a little bit differently. You guys, I mean, if you're investing $300 to $500 million a year, I mean, that's a massive scale.
And we've returned 3 times our money for the last three. Obviously, this year has been tough. But the last 3-4 years before that, the cash on cash returns have been incredible. I mean, obviously, they're not Sequoia level when they were at their peak. 3.5 times cash on cash with
that's pretty good.
Strategic benefit is nothing to sneeze at.
No, definitely. How do you, in the core company, how do you create that culture of innovation that's so important in tech?
Yeah, I'd say it's not easy. I think there are 3 or 4 different elements that I think, standing back almost as a consultant and looking at the company culturally, I can point to. The first is there is an arrogance, maybe arrogance is not in a pejorative, but in a cultural sense, that Intel should be solving the most difficult problems in our industry, right? There's a belief set, there's an ownership based upon our heritage, based upon Intel Labs, all the things that we've done in the past in terms of inventions, right? So Intel invented Wi-Fi, Intel invented USB, and there's many things that Intel has invented for the industry, right? And right. So there's this heritage and belief set that we are stewards of the industry in terms of innovation. And that goes a long way in terms of mindset, in terms of aspiration, in terms of interactions with others. So that's a very big thing. The second thing that I think drives our culture is that we reward and incent people who are contrarian and who come up with things that may actually not have any commercial benefit, but we're culturally very comfortable with those people walking around. We have these people called special engineers, and I forget the actual title they have. But these are people that kind of roam around the company. It's like 100 of them. They don't really have any real accountability, except if you put them in a job with accountability. But if they don't, be your CTO or run an engineering team, but they don't have to. And their main job is to look for problems that are important for the company, to describe them, and then to create a team to go attack it. And sometimes they borrow, beg and steal. Sometimes they go get money from the corporation. But these leaders, these 100 or so folks, you have to be incredibly, I mean, Pat is one of these people, right? You have to be voted by your peers that you can become this type of person. And then all of a sudden, you have latitude to do some whatever you think is important for the company. And they roam around. I have one or two of them in my organization. And they are quasi CTO, but they don't have to be. But they are the technical brains of the company. Very, very important. And even with all the cost reduction and so on and so forth, it's almost sacrosanct to cut these people, right? So that's a very important part of the culture. And we reward, in order for you to become a fellow, we call them Intel fellows, you have to be done something amazing. And they also create, they also have the ability to challenge anything because they're not really accountable from a P&L or they have total job security. These folks, they will challenge anything. I mean, they'll challenge the CEO. They are totally not afraid to challenge. They're not business people. They're very technical, you know, sort of innovation type people. I think the third thing that drives innovation in the company is that we're incredibly, there's a culture of paranoia, right? Andy Grove famously, you know, sort of coined this term that only the paranoid survive. And so there's a real, sometimes to our own detriment, of total paranoia around secrets, around benchmarking, trying to understand, you know, we're always afraid somebody's going to kill us, right? So there's a, and that drives innovation, right? So it's not good enough for it to be this way. We need to get to this Moore's law, right? We need to keep driving this thing because otherwise somebody's going, you know, the water is going to come over us. So those aspects of the culture really drive both a focus on big problems, the audacity that Intel should be the one to solve them, and then set a talent in the organization that can do it, right? Can put a team together to go address it. Now that has its negatives, right? So in none of those things did I say that there was business innovation, right? So we don't have fellows that are business fellows, if you will, that are kind of thinking hard about whether or not we should change the business model, or we don't have people who are obsessing about customer experience. Or the engineer experience, or the, you know, in ways that other companies do, right? There's real strengths, but there's things that we think we can improve on.
How does that translate into the kind of people that you look to hire? What do you look for in them?
You know, we're 140,000 people, so we have
a lot of hiring.
It's a lot. So our head of HR is busy. Her team is very busy. And, you know, we hire factories, we hire for engineering, we hire software, we hire a sales team, we have a big sales team. But I'll say that I think if you're asking the question at the executive level, right? So the management level, in the sort of the working level, is very clear, right? We're looking for talent, but we also very interestingly, very comfortable and very biased towards what I'd call talent that is non-conventional talent. We hire a lot from people going to school part-time or going to community college. We found great talent in community colleges, people who have technical community colleges. We do a lot of work ourselves creating curriculum for different colleges to train our people, to train people that we'll hire. So we invest at the sort of the first line, if you will, of the engineering teams, a lot of money to create talent that is for Intel. We spend a lot of time on that. At the executive level, you know, when we're looking for talent, when I say executive level, you know, sort of three or four levels below the CEO, a lot of things we're looking for: engineering, people with a very strong engineering background. Intel is a very engineering driven company. Even the way we present material in a business setting is very engineering centric, right? It's in some ways it's a bit like McKinsey. It's very fact-based. It's all about facts and charts and benchmarks and so on and so forth. That's how we make decisions. And that's how, at least that's how we think we make decisions. Actually, that's not the case. But The culture is very much for you to survive. You need to really embrace this sort of very engineering centric way of communicating. So we look for that. We're hiring executives. So you could have gone and done many other things, but having that engineering backbone is very important.
Let's switch to some topics in tech. We won't get to my full list, but we have to start with AI.
Sure.
So what are some of the things that you find particularly exciting about the way that AI is unfolding in the world?
In terms of excitement, I would say the things that blow my mind away. So you asked the question in the pre-stuff, am I a bull or a bear?
Yeah.
I'd say I'm a long-term bull.
Okay.
I think literally at the beginning stages of how AI is going to change our world, right? In some ways, I think about it like early 90s when you had Yahoo and Hotmail and AOL and so on and so forth. That's where we are right now, right? So, yeah, people are just, it's first order stuff, right? And that honestly is not going to be that value creating. It is value creating in the sense that we created AOL, Yahoo was created, Hotmails, but they don't exist anymore because the delta in terms of value creation was not significant, right? I think what was really significant, especially in the mobile internet, was things like E-Trade and eBay. And then you had things like Uber and things like Airbnb, things that fundamentally economically are so disruptive and could never have existed before the mobile internet. I think that is when you create a ton of value. And I don't think we're there yet with AI. We're just at the beginning stage where we're talking about first order type impact. When we get to second, third order type impact, where you're actually sort of splitting apart, creating an Amazon business model only because you can have, you know, such transparency in terms of using the internet, that's when the music industry totally transforming. We are not there yet, right? And so that's what I'm saying, but we're going to get there. It's just hard for me to predict. But when we get there, I think it's going to be amazing. The places where we kind of have gotten there already are things like autonomous driving. It is, I don't know if you've had the opportunity to sit in one of the mobilized cars or where you can experience L4 driving. So we own Mobileye 90% and recently spun them off. And I went to Israel for a board meeting and they picked me up at the airport and they drove me from the airport to Jerusalem, to the streets. And if you've been to Israel before, it's like driving in Cairo or driving in Lagos or driving in Mexico City, right? People, the rules are just suggestions, right? And level four driving all the way, the guy did not touch the wheel except to point in the directions we're going to go. And this car kind of figured it out, including how to edge yourself into a circle, everything. And that is only possible because of AI. AI has transformed the idea of safety, the idea of autonomous driving. In many ways, for me, that is an example of a bull, what we're going to see leveraging AI that we've not seen yet. And so for me, those things like automation, especially in robotics and in automobiles, the things that are super exciting. Other things that are very exciting are like, I don't know if you've seen video search using LLMs, or you've seen people using AI to create videos, deep fakes and so on and so forth. It is just mind-boggling to me how compelling and difficult to spot the difference it is.
And don't you guys run an ad campaign saying you can spot the differences though?
We can. We can. That's the really cool thing. We have an antidote and we can actually figure it out. But that stuff for me is very compelling. It's all the stuff that everybody right now is talking about in terms of the scale of the large language models and the text-based sort of prediction stuff that you see with ChatGPT and so on and so forth. Those are pretty cool. I mean, we've also seen quite a lot of performance improvement with writing software. That's pretty cool in terms of all of those things. I think those are sort of generation A1 or sort of first order things. And that is fantastic. I mean, we would love to get 25, 50% productivity from our software designers by using sort of a copilot or a tool.
Yeah.
And so of course we're going down that path, but I think we are 5 years from the disruption of search. Search is, I don't know, $180 billion business for Google right now. Imagine that being disrupted, right? I think those things are the things that I'm excited about seeing. Not that I want Google to be disrupted, but those are the things that I think I'm a long-term bull on.
Does that make you a short-term bear or just not sure?
I think it's overhyped. I'm short-term overhyped, right? So I think it's a little bit overhyped right now. The hype is over, is too high for the current value creation on the ground. But I think the industry will grow into the valuations.
I guess, you know, I just wonder, what's the economic impact of this, right? In terms of make sure software developers 20 or 30 or 40 or 50% more productive, that's great as long as you keep hiring the same number of them, right? If it makes them more productive and then you need fewer of them and you do that on a massive scale, it could end up being disruptive in a different way. And it's hard to say. We've had lots of change. You and I have watched them in our adult lives, right? You mentioned some of them, you know, just the internet and mobile phones and all the things that have been, by and large, massive positives in the scheme of things. You go back to manufacturing moving overseas or automation taking away jobs, and those are the things that are tougher. And it's a little bit hard to know where robotics and AI specifically, are going to play out in terms of that kind of continuum, if you think about it that way.
No, I agree. And that's why I say that in the first order is what everybody's looking at right now, which is, hey, essentially, I'm going to stop hiring people and just hire AI bots to do my work for me, especially white collar work. That's a first order thing. That's interesting. It's like having a bot to help your call center agents answer questions, right? So I get that.
Yeah.
I think the places where the AI will make a huge difference, frankly, it's hard to predict. In places like healthcare, I mean, let's take healthcare for a minute, right? So we have a business, a small incubation business that allows, can take pictures of you even now, and we can tell your heart rate and your, whether or not you're having problems with breathing or something's wrong with your eyes. And we can combine it with actual readings, and we can sort of democratize, AI has the potential to really democratize a lot of the very sophisticated sensing that happens in the West and make it widely available across the globe. We have a technology that can watch you move, walk, and tell whether or not your recovery from a knee operation is going well or not, or whether or not you have a problem that needs surgery. Or it can watch a baby to tell whether or not you need to bring the baby in because it's breathing. I mean, so all these things where sort of take a NICU and take it out of the NICU and make it much more available. I think those things using AI for me could be truly compelling and transformational. Yeah. And we are only at the beginning stages. One of the biggest constraints is data to train these models, right? I'll give you an example. One of the things that we've been trying to train our models on for, you know, we have this business that allows for people doing rehab. It can give you a lot of very good, using a sense of very good feedback upon your performance. One of the big challenges is, it turns out you can't just train it on white men in New York. You have to, Chinese bodies are slightly differently, African bodies are slightly differently. And so you have to get a broad set of data to train these models on. And one of the things that you have to figure out how to do is, how do you do that in a way that makes these models effective globally? So those are some of the things that we're struggling with, or we're wrestling with.
What about quantum computing?
I think very early stages. We have a lot of research and work going on in our labs. The potential benefits are pretty substantial. The technical challenge to be able to get that done is non-trivial, and we're trying, right? I mean, as part of my portfolio work at Intel, it's in my bottom left box.
Yeah.
So it's in there and we're dabbling in it, but I don't think it's ready for prime time yet.
Yeah. Did you go to the Consumer Electronics Show?
Yeah, I went to CES.
Yeah.
Mostly a lot of meetings. I walked the halls 2 or 3 times. I got to tell you, the thing that is really clearer and clearer every time I go to see it, I mean, this is the second time I've been, is how the auto industry is just totally computers on wheels, right? I mean, it is, the transformation happening in the auto industry is breathtaking.
Yeah. They've kind of gone kicking and screaming into it. If you go back 20 years ago, I think it was really just I don't know whether it was the sort of rise of the battery powered vehicles or whether it came before that, but I mean, it's gone completely the other way. I mean, it is pretty incredible what you get in a car these days.
It's breathtaking. And part of it is the Chinese OEMs have really shown the world. I mean, Tesla's shown it, but everybody's like, yeah, it's just Tesla. And now the Chinese OEMs are, you know, like BYD and Zeekr are really showing that, hey, if you think about it like as a computer on wheels, you can be so disruptive. And as you said, the others are being, they're finally getting there, but they're getting there difficult way, right? I mean, it's not their natural instinct, but that industry will be unrecognizable 5 years from now.
Yeah. I mean, it's unrecognizable relative to, I think about when I was a kid and car had a carburetor, you know, it was a mechanical thing. Now, you can't do anything in terms of figuring out how to fix a car without a computer hooked up to it, getting diagnostic data. And it's the old days of like machining parts and fixing cars. And
it's like having a sewing machine.
Yeah. Those still exist though.
Well, yeah, we still have Porsche, other people who have those, they just be $150,000 each, right? And difficult. Yeah. But you know, you go to China, I was in China about 6 months ago, and you see the innovation happening in the auto industry and what you can, of course, highly subsidized by the government and so on and so forth. But it is astounding. It's pretty cool. So I think for me, that's what I took away, that the acceleration of the auto.
It says something that the auto manufacturers are even at the Consumer Electronics Show.
Yes.
That would not have happened 20 years ago.
Absolutely. And they have their own wing. I mean, it's, yeah, it just says a lot. I mean, to be honest, the other consumer electronics stuff, because mobile is largely kind of flat, a lot of stuff on TVs, like there's this transparent TV from Samsung. It's interesting. Mm. It's gimmicky, but interesting. There's a lot of sort of robots for cleaning and sort of in the house robots activities going on. But in terms of real sort of the way you and I think about from our training at McKinsey around innovation in terms of value creation or value destruction, the auto one is just out of control.
Yeah. We're going to run out of time. So two last questions. Over the years, what are the strengths that you've relied on again and again? And what are the things you've really had to work at developing?
It's a great question. And I thought about it a lot when I read it. I'll say, look, my training as an engineer and at McKinsey really built my analytical skills, right? I think that is a strength that I've relied on a ton, right? How do you disaggregate, put stuff back together, 7 steps of problem solving? How do you create an issue tree and do it in your head and analyze and bring it together? How do you be contributed to ask the right questions because you have the issue tree in your head? That training from being an engineer to being a McKinsey consultant, frankly, is a skill that, or capability, a muscle that I rely on all the time. I think the piece that I've had to work on is, frankly, what I now rely on more than my analytical skills, frankly, is what I would call the EQ part. Being able to really listen when people are talking and meeting and really understand how they're feeling. Trying to get in tune with what people are feeling to really understand what is motivating them, how they're going to make a decision. Because even in a place like Intel, highly engineering driven, 99% of all the decisions are emotional, are all EQ driven versus IQ. Because when it comes down to it, it's about how people feel, what they're afraid of, what they're excited about, who they trust, who they don't trust, how experiences they've had in the past that has scarred them and therefore leading them to one decision versus the other. And so the muscle, the capability that I've really had to work on, right, is not the IQ stuff, the analytics stuff, but it's really getting much better at listening and really tuning in on the EQ side. I talk about to my team all the time that when you're talking to people, when you're presenting, when you're trying to compel people, you always got to think about how they're going to present it to their boss and how they're going to feel doing that and make sure you tune into that rather than the logic that you're trying to persuade them with. For me, that's been the thing that I've worked on the most.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you talk about how much of the decision-making is driven by that in a place like Intel, right? Which is a very engineering-centric company. I mean, imagine what you would be saying if you worked in something that's much less technical.
Ralph Lauren.
Fashion. What do you, when you think back, wish that you'd known when you were fresh out of MIT?
I think the one thing that I wish I'd known is how precious it is to build and maintain your networks. The networks that you build when you are 22, 23 to 35, 36, the people you meet who are all going to go do, try and change the world in their own way are pretty important. And what I found when I was at McKinsey, and then if it was the case with you, with your business school buddies or your undergrad buddies, is that you get a bit tunneled into the work, right? And you don't spend enough time kind of coming up for air and kind of learning what others are doing and staying in touch and building their network. Because first of all, it's fun. And second of all, as you get older and as you get more mature, it is much more fun to have had a broad network, get advice to do things. And for me, that's this. I've corrected it over the last few years, but I wish if I had to do it all again, I think I would have done more of that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I had, when you do all those projects, right, and you work with so many different companies and different industries, you develop a very eclectic network, right? From your time at McKinsey. I mean, LinkedIn didn't exist when I was at McKinsey. I left before LinkedIn was rolled out.
But
I mean,
at this, that really dates you.
I know. Well, a lot of things date me these days, Saf. But if you think about, like, there's zero excuse not to stay up with a network, especially now that we've got all these social media outlets for doing it. And I mean, it's more than that. Obviously, it's, I mean, however many thousand people you're connected to on LinkedIn, you obviously don't know them all equally well. And finding a way to sort of supplement the mass scan that you can do by looking at your social media feed with catch-ups or running into people at industry conferences. And I'm sure you found it's a lot different. When you go really deep in an industry as you have now, you know, you start to develop a much deeper industry network than you get, even if you're doing a lot of work in that industry as a McKinsey person. It's just different. They both sort of pre and post, or at McKinsey, post McKinsey, have both been good in their own way, but you developed very different networks. And no matter what, it really does matter. That's for sure.
I have to say the McKinsey network has been very special. I've really appreciated the McKinsey network post leaving the firm. The readiness of everybody to pick up the phone and help. That's been pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wasn't there nearly as long as you were, but when you've been at McKinsey, you're a partner, you know, and you say you were a partner at McKinsey. I mean, you've got, even if you weren't a partner, if you were just an engagement manager, didn't stay quite as long, you've got credibility with people. They'll generally take your call, right? They'll give you 15 minutes of their time and they'll try and help. And that's part of that network has definitely been very good over the years.
Yeah, awesome.
All right. I know we're probably past time, so I appreciate you doing this. It was good to catch up. We'll have to maybe not wait 18 years this time.
Yeah, I know. Next time I'm in London, I'll definitely drop you a note.
Yeah, that'd be great because it's pretty rare for me to get to Washington, D.C. So I'd love to catch up in person.
All right, boss.
All right. Thanks, Saf.
Cheers.
I want to thank Saf for joining me today to discuss his role at Intel, some of the exciting advancements in technology, and a little bit about his own career journey as well. If you'd like to make the most of your career, visit pathwise.io. You can become a member. Basic membership is free. You can also sign up on the website for our newsletter. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to Career Sessions, Career Lessons. We hope the nuggets of wisdom shared today help guide your path to the successful career of your dreams. This podcast series is part of Pathwise.io, which is here to help you live the career you want. We provide a comprehensive mix of career and professional development events, insights, tools, and exercises backed by a group of leading coaches and other career management experts. If you aspire to something more or just something different in your career, join us at pathwise.io. You can find us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. See you again on the next episode.